This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Henry Louis Gates, is one of the most prominent scholars of African American history. Even so, he says he sometimes has to remind himself that race is not just a black thing. It signifies a lot of different kinds of people in different places. And African Americans in this country don't have a patent on the term or on the social conditions that have resulted from slavery and its long aftermath. Those are among the reasons he wrote his new book, Black in Latin America, about what it means to be black in places south of our border. The book is a companion to a PBS series he did last spring, for which he traveled to six countries, Brazil, Cuba, the Dominican Republic, Haiti, Mexico, and Peru. Gates directs the W.E.B. Du Bois Institute for African and African American Research at Harvard. He's hosted 11 PBS specials, including ones that traced people's genealogy through their DNA, exploring how race and ethnicity are more complex than we think. Gates is also famous for his dispute with a police officer that led to the Obama Beer Summit. Henry Louis Gates, welcome back to Fresh Air. There is so much in your book that I did not know. I was really so uninformed about slavery south of our border and the ongoing racial implications of that. Why did countries south of our border have so many more slaves than the U.S.?
Well, Terry, between 1502 and 1866, 12.5 million Africans got on the ships from Africa sailing to the New World as slaves. 11.2 million disembarked in the New World. And of that 11.2 million, how many came to the United States? 450,000. 388,000 came directly, and another 70,000 or so stopped briefly in the Caribbean and then came to the United States. All the rest went to the Caribbean and Latin America. Brazil got 4.8 million slaves alone. Now, when I was growing up, I don't know about you, but essentially I thought to talk about the slave trade meant to talk about the experience of our ancestors here in the United States. But it turns out that the real, quote-unquote, African-American experience, judging by numbers alone, unfolded south of our border, south, as it were, of Key West and Texas. And that world is the world that I wanted to unveil or explicate. Now, there are many scholars who have been working in this field for a long time. But the average American, and I'd say even the average academic, the average journalist, has no idea of the huge number of black people who landed south of the United States over the course of the slave trade.
Now, you write the real African-American experience took place in Latin America and in the Caribbean. But one of the things you found in common in just about all of the countries you visited is that the descendants of Africans don't identify as African-American.
Now, America is very peculiar because of the history of slavery and racism, in that we have the law of hypodescent. And you know what that is, the one-drop rule. If you have one drop of black ancestry, then you were black historically. And you know what, Terry? That's even true today. That was recently affirmed by a Supreme Court decision in the mid-1980s. So if that rule applied throughout Latin America, my God, there would be several hundred million people that we would define as black. Officially, there are about 120 million people of African descent in Latin America. But using the law of hypodescent, there would be many hundred million more. So that in Brazil, whereas we have black and white, in the old days we used to have black, white, and mulatto, say, in the 1890 census. In Brazil today, they have 134 categories of blackness. 130. It's like octoroon and quadroon are on steroids in Brazil. And I list these 134 categories as an appendix in the book, along with different color categories in each of the countries in which I filmed and which I've written about in this new book.
And what is the point of having so many color categories? What is it supposed to indicate?
Well, you can look at it two ways. For most African Americans, the first time you go to Brazil or the first time you go to Haiti or Cuba and you encounter all these categories, you think this is a way of fleeing blackness, we would say in the barbershop. This is a way of not wanting to be black. Well, I'm not black, I'm a Moreno. Or I'm not black, I'm a kabuko, or one of the many other hundred words that people use to describe a gradation of blackness, hair texture, facial features. But on the other hand, you could say that these societies have refused to be locked in this ridiculous binary opposition between black and white as we are here in America, and they've socially constructed race or ethnicity in a more subtle way than we could ever imagine. So it's you could take your pick. The history of each of these countries involves, first of all, a tremendous influx of slaves, of blackness, followed by, Terry, a period of whitening. In Brazil, it's called branqueamento.
That's one of the things I found really amazing, that there was actually policies in some of these countries to bring in more Europeans, and the subtext was to whiten the complexion of the country.
Yeah, well, let's take Brazil. As I said, Brazil got 4.8 million Africans arriving in the slave trade. And remember, Brazil did not abolish slavery until 1888, which is very, very recently. Cuba, 1886. Brazil, 1888. So Brazil, the second largest black nation in the world, using our definitions of blackness. But simultaneously, between 1884 and 1939, Brazil imported 4.0 million Europeans and another 185,000 Japanese in a conscious policy called branqueamento, which was meant to whiten the country. Mexico had a policy of whitening. Cuba had a policy of whitening. And those policies persisted well into the 20th century.
But let me understand this more clearly. So in the countries that had this policy of whitening and they brought in Europeans, I mean, you can't exactly bring in Europeans and say, okay, so now we want you to have sexual relationships with people of color so that your children will be whiter. I mean, like, how exactly was that supposed to work?
Let's see, a little rum, a little heat, a little merengue. What's that the prescription for?
Were they just bringing in men and not families?
No, there were obviously more men that came in, but they were trying to do two things. First of all, bring in, when they could, white families so that the white population per se would increase and white people would marry white people. So the quote-unquote number of pure white people, as it were, would increase in relationship to the number of quote-unquote pure black people. But they also presumed, because so many of these indentured immigrants would be men, that interracial sexual liaisons would ensue. And indeed, they did. So that whitening was to be achieved in two ways. White on white, as it were, through white couples, white people marrying white people, and, as it were, a browning movement when a series of racial gradations would be created through interracial sexuality.
Now, you found that in a couple of countries, at least a couple of countries in Latin America, that the census does not include race. And that mm-hmm. may seem kind of liberating, like you're not defining yourself by race, but it turns out there was a downside to that as well.
Absolutely. In Mexico, my hero, President Vicente, was part of a movement. Now, he's elected in 1829, but he's part of a movement earlier on so that by 1822, it is decided that no public record, no census will ever record race forever in Mexico. So, and they all thought this was a liberal thing because if you don't have races, you can't have racism. That's how the argument went. Well, there's a slight problem with that. If, because of historical reasons, the people who were disproportionately discriminated against happen to be that group of people with dark skin, kinky hair, and thick lips, how do you count them if you don't have a census category? So the most vibrant political movements in both Peru and Mexico today involving race have to do with fighting for the right to have race reintroduced in the federal census. And in spite of the fact that just recently, 2 years ago, the Peruvian government apologized, did something unprecedented. It apologized to its Afro descendants, as they're called there, for historical discrimination. Didn't mention slavery, but it mentioned anti-black racism. And that's quite progressive. In spite of that, there is no indication that categories of black or brown, negro or mulatto will be introduced on the census. And until that's done, political activists can't organize to argue for things like affirmative action or more equal opportunity because they have no statistics. A great academic told me that he went to the government to complain about the lack of blacks in at higher education, and he said that there were so few blacks in higher education because of historical racism, and he was told, we don't have racism because we don't have races. And we don't have, if you can't count the race, then you can't have racism. And that is the pernicious argument that they're trying to fight with this movement to expand the categories on the federal census.
So it didn't have legislated racism like we did in the United States where we had, mm-hmm. Segregation. But so it was a kind of ad hoc racism or?
Yeah, it was de facto rather than de jure. In Cuba, there weren't laws against blacks doing this. There were social customs, which Fidel Castro, you could say what you want about the evils of communism and the all the things that were wrong about the communist revolution in Cuba. But one of the things that many people, black people and many academics told me that the Cuban Revolution got right was that it ended all these informal practices like social clubs, blacks couldn't go to the beaches, interracial marriage. And the same thing obtained throughout much of Latin America. Abdias do Nascimento, the Nelson Mandela of Brazil, who just died, really a great man at the age of 96. I think the height of traveling around these countries and interviewing people was actually meeting him because he'd been my hero for so long. He said to me that Jim Crow segregation did our people, the African Americans, a favor because we had something to rail against. He said they never had a civil rights movement because they had no de jure segregation. They had no legal segregation. So it was like trying to combat a chimera, you know, that there was nothing that they could touch, could grasp to fight. And people would say, again, well, what are you talking about? You work hard, you can make it. Show me the law that prevents you from making it. Where in fact, the overwhelming percent of the people who live in the favelas are people of obvious African descent.
The favelas are the slums.
Yeah, like the City of God. We all know that movie. The favelas are the slums, and they're disproportionately black and brown.
You know, one of the things I find interesting, so much of your book is about, you know, the color differentiations in Latin American countries and how they don't identify as having African ancestry, even though African ancestry is such an essential part of Latin America. But, you know, when a Latin American comes to the United States, like, they're just Latin American. You know, and most, so many Americans can't even distinguish between what's the difference between Dominican and Mexican and Brazilian. You know, it's a brown person, and there's going to be discrimination based on that.
Absolutely. When my favorite country to explore this question was the Dominican Republic. In the Dominican Republic, I love the people. I love merengue. I love the food. I love its great traditions. But in the Dominican Republic, I spent 2 weeks asking people who would definitely be called black in this country how they describe themselves. And to a woman or a man, they each describe themselves as Indio. Indio. Though overwhelmingly the mitochondrial DNA of each of the, I think according to one scholar, 84% of the country, the mitochondrial DNA, your mother's 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 DNA, goes straight back to Africa. Now, they are a mixed people, and they are more mixed than their neighbors in Haiti because of the peculiarities of the history of slavery. They had a cattle-based economy, and their slaves came early on, and the roles in the cattle industry tended to make people more equal, so there was much more interbreeding. But when I asked, who's black then? Who's Negro? You know what they said? They said, oh, the Haitians. The Haitians are the Negroes. We don't have any of them here. I asked Juan Rodriguez, one of the people I interviewed, a cultural anthropologist, when he found out that he was black. And he said, because he was very proud, he said, I'm a black Dominican. This is a problem for our country. So I said, Juan, why are you different? how do you know that you're black? When did you find that out? Did your parents teach you? He said, my parents, I found out when I went to New York. he wants all the Dominicans to have to go to New York because they undergo this transformation of identification.
So how do you think your skin color might have affected you if you were growing up, say, in Brazil?
Well, my father, God rest his soul, worked for 37 years in a paper mill in the daytime and was a janitor at the Chesapeake and Potomac Telephone Company at night in the hills of West Virginia, Piedmont, West Virginia. So I, judging from other people in my social class, which would have been working class that I see today in each of these countries, we wouldn't be having this interview. I never would have gotten into Yale. Because I was part of the affirmative action generation. Class of 66 at Yale had six black guys to graduate. The class that entered with me in September 69 had 96 black men and women. What was there, a genetic blip in the race and all of a sudden there were 90 smart black people? Of course not. You know, Barack Obama, would he have gotten into Columbia and Harvard Law School without affirmative action? I doubt it, you know, though I think he's a brilliant man. There were just strict racist quotas at historically white colleges on the number of us who could matriculate there. And generally, you had to be a rich kid or the child of a doctor or lawyer or politician or something. And that would have excluded me, no matter how intelligent I may or may not be, or certainly would have excluded President Obama, given his class background. So if you consider that and then drop us into Brazil or Peru or Haiti, no, I would not be a professor at Harvard and I would not be making films for PBS, and I wouldn't have written any of the books that I've written. Race was a tremendous obstacle and is a tremendous obstacle in each of these countries. And I would say fleeing blackness is a consistent theme that I saw. That the lighter you were, it's like we used to say, my father used to say, his generation, our generation, if you're white, you're all right. If you're black, get back. If you're brown, stick around. And that simple little phrase obtains throughout each of these countries. And now, because of scholars, white, black, and brown, insisting on retrieving the history of African culture in these countries, and because of David Eltis's Transatlantic Slave Trade Database, and because of conscious policies starting to trickle down from various aspects of the governments in these different societies, it's beginning to change. There's more of a black consciousness movement.
So one of the series that you did for PBS was about genealogy. And you had you had several high-profile Americans do their genealogy, you know, through their DNA to see what really, what were their roots really. So you did it yourself, too. What did you learn about your own genetic background that surprised you most?
Well, for me, the most shocking thing, the most amazing thing was my admixture. And your admixture, Terry, is your percentage of African ancestry, Native American ancestry or Asian ancestry, and European ancestry. And Dr. Rick Kittle's black geneticist now teaches at the University of Illinois Medical School, Chicago Circle, revealed to the world that I, the director of the Du Bois Institute of African and African American Research, was half a white man. That my admixture was almost exactly 50-50 African and European. It was quite an astonishing moment for me. I had no idea. And my family on both sides had always said we had Native Americans. Every black American thinks that they have a tremendous amount of Native American descent. Very few African Americans have any Native American descent. I had zero Native American ancestry, zero Native American DNA. And the real stopper is that if we did the Y DNA, which only men have and you get from your father, if we tested the Y DNA of all the black men, say, in the NBA or all the black men in America, one in three of us, including me, one in three, actually about 35%, a little bit more than one in three, of us descend not from a black man at all, but from a white man who impregnated a black woman under horrible conditions in slavery.
So finding out that your DNA was like 50% white and 50% black, African, did that change your identity in any way?
No, I thought it was cool. You know, I thought, you see, what I love about our use of DNA in the PBS series is that it explodes the notions of racial purity. No black person that we have tested is 100% African, no matter how dark they are. I tested Don Cheadle and Chris Rock, who are darker, and both made jokes about being dark. And one of the reasons we have different criteria for selecting people to be in the series, and one is phenotype. I wanted medium brown black people, light-complected black people, and darker black people. And these are just facts of biological life. Not one is 100% African. We have never tested a 100% African-American. So that means that no matter what the laws were in the daytime tearing, when the lights came down, everybody was sleeping with everybody else. Now, that I don't mean to elide the horrendous tradition of brutality and rape and coercion that figure suggests. But also we found there were willing relationships. Morgan Freeman's ancestors, his great-grandfather was white. His great-grandmother was black. They had children during slavery, so you would just presume rape. But after 1870, they lived together. They couldn't get married in Mississippi, but they even died together. We found the gravestones. They're buried right next to each other. It's enormously complicated. It's difficult to generalize, though generally we can say that the bulk of those interracial relationships were in slavery and could not possibly have been between two equals and no doubt reflected force or coercion.
So I'm going to change the subject for a second and bring up something you're probably like really tired of talking about it, but we've never talked about it on the show. You and I have not talked about it. And I'm thinking of the July 2009 incident.
Oh, well, what happened there? I was filming. I was filming a new series. Is that what you're referring to?
No. So, as everybody knows, you were coming home from a trip and realized you were locked out of your home. So your driver helped you break into your home so you could get in. A neighbor or passerby reported it as breaking and entering. Sergeant James Crowley showed up to see what was up. He asked you to step outside. You refused. And thus ensued a now famous conflict to which President Obama intervened and brought you both for a beer summit with the president and the vice president. So a very kind of famous incident that President Obama tried to make into a teachable moment. What did you get out of that? What's like the moral of the story for you?
Well, I was returning from filming Yo-Yo Ma's ancestry in China. So I'm pretty pumped up, also exhausted. I'd spent the night in New York, and someone had tried to break into my house while I was in China. That wasn't reported. That's why the door was locked. I had my keys.
Oh, I didn't know that part.
Yeah, and a man named Driss, who's Moroccan, was driving me, and he's a friend. He's a big man, and I was calling, my house is owned by Harvard, so I was calling the real estate office, and I said, Driss, just put your shoulder against it, and they'll fix the lock, because the lock's jammed anyway. So he did, and this very nice lady was walking by, and then the story falls apart, because according to the police, there was one story, according to her, there's another story, but essentially it's reported two black guys are breaking into this house. And then this police officer shows up and asks me to step out on the porch, and I said, no, I didn't think that was a good idea, just by his tone. And then you know all the details after that.
So what was the moral of the story for you? What did you get out of all the different ways that the story played out, including the meeting with President Obama?
It's very interesting. My secretary of 16 years, Joanne Kendall, she was shocked. She told me that in spite of working with me for 16 years of being in African-American studies, she did not realize the depth of racism and hatred that could manifest itself. She was fielding phone calls just from lunatics. I mean, people saying terrible things that I should die or I shouldn't go here or there. My children, my family could be killed. But the day after the beer summit, all the phone calls and all the hate mail went away. Now, I don't know where those people went, but I know that what Barack Obama did was brilliant, because it brought two people who were afraid of each other, me and Officer Crowley. And it turns out, by the way, we did Officer Crowley's DNA. It turned out, Terry, that we did Officer Crowley's DNA. And he and I are both descended from this something called the Uniel haplotype. 8% of all the men in Ireland have the same identical Y DNA genetic signature. So Officer Crowley and I are distant cousins. And he and I have gotten to know each other, and we have very friendly communication. And I can't speak for him, but I think that it was our actions were defined by, you know, fear and tremendous amount of anxiety. And I hope that it would be a lesson for the police department in how to avoid making a similar kind of mistake. And I hope it would be a lesson for those people being questioned by the police to be as cooperative as possible, because you're essentially powerless. You know, all you can do is be as respectful as you possibly can be. But I also hope that what President Obama did helps us to understand that communication across racial lines, even at times of intense anxiety or animosity, is the ultimate solution. That it's better to sit two people down and let them talk to each other and let the whole country talk about it, which they did, than to allow us to go to our separate corners and continue to hate each other.
Well, Henry Louis Gates, it's been great to talk with you again. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Terry. Thank you for having me on the program.
Henry Louis Gates directs the W.E.B. Du Bois Institute for African and African American Research at Harvard. His new book is called Black in Latin America. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org. Coming up, Brendan Gleeson, who stars in the new film The Guard, co-starred in Bruges, and played Mad-Eye Moody in three Harry Potter films. This is Fresh Air. You may have seen our next guest, Irish actor Brendan Gleeson, in a half dozen films and not known his name. He played Mad-Eye Moody in three Harry Potter films. He starred with Colin Farrell in the film In Bruges and also appeared in Gangs of New York, Cold Mountain, 28 Days Later, and Braveheart. And he won an Emmy Award for his portrayal of Winston Churchill in the HBO movie Into the Storm. Gleeson stars with Don Cheadle in the new film The Guard. It's a dark comedy set in rural Ireland. Gleeson plays a seasoned but eccentric policeman who has to work with an American FBI agent played by Cheadle on an international drug smuggling case. Gleeson spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies. Let's start with a scene from The Guard. Gleeson and Cheadle's characters are having tea, talking about how to proceed with the case.
So what do you have planned for your day?
Well, we obviously don't know who killed McCormick or why. And there's no real useful forensic evidence at the crime scene, so I thought we might start by canvassing the neighborhood around where the body was discovered, see if anybody might have heard something. And we also have to consider the fact that McCormick was probably reconnoitering drop-off points all along the coast. Sergeant.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, you lost me at we.
We. You and I.
It's my day off. Did I not tell you?
It's your day off.
I've had it booked for a good while. You can ask Stanton.
Let me get this straight. We're investigating a murder and the trafficking of over $500,000.
Billion.
$500 million worth of cocaine, and you telling me it's your day off.
I'm sure 24 hours won't make any difference.
24 hours won't make any difference.
I was saying it doesn't, these cop shows and telly, but it doesn't, not in my experience. Anyway, why do you keep repeating everything I say?
Well, Brendan Gleeson, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thanks, Dave.
That's, of course, you and Don Cheadle in your new film, The Guard. You know, I read in the production notes to this film, you were quoted as saying, after you read the part, anybody who didn't take that part should lock himself into a small room and shoot himself. describe this character, Jerry Boyle.
Well, I mean, he's a lot of things, but essentially he's a policeman who reads a lot, watches a lot of movies, drinks too much, and basically is going slowly out of his mind because of lack of things to engage his intellect with. He has a number of people in his life, but not many. His mother being one of them, who is not well, and very few other people, really. So he has become cynical and a little bored, and he likes to ruffle people's feathers. So he's a kind of a lonely cynic waiting for something to happen.
Anybody you drew on for this role?
Not specifically. I mean, I would have met men like this quite a lot. People who are underused a little bit and who have
terribly sharp wit and pretend to be very, very stupid. It seems to be quite a common thing, particularly in the countryside in Ireland, that I don't know whether it comes from going to market or whatever, but countrymen quite a lot of the time pretend to be incredibly stupid so that you will underestimate them and not really understand who you're dealing with. And I think this guy is very reminiscent of that.
Right. Now, this takes place in a little town in Western Ireland called Connemara, which is a real place, right?
Well, Connemara is it's a district, really. It's west of Galway City, and it kind of encompasses quite a large area, really, for Ireland. Much of it is Gaelic-speaking, and it has a particular kind of a magical sort of appeal for people in Ireland. It is rural, and it changes, it reinvents itself all the time, but it's held on to the language, which is unusual in Ireland. There are only maybe three, maybe four places in Ireland where Gaelic is spoken as a living language, and Connemara is one of them. And so it kind of represents a place that not everybody can break into anyway, in terms of understanding exactly what's going on. And so Jerry Boyle would be very much a product of that, in the sense that it's very difficult to know exactly what's going on in Jerry's head at any point anyway.
Right. And he has great fun when the FBI agent, Everett, goes around and tries to interview people. And even when they understand his English, they will not speak to him in English. Right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, because they understand that he's an FBI man, and therefore he's associated with authority and the law, and they prefer to keep things going the way they like to keep things going. There's a history there maybe of not colluding with the law too often. So Jerry and Wendell kind of agree that it's sort of Compton-esque in that regard, in the attitude to authority.
If you're just joining us, our guest is actor Brendan Gleeson. He stars in the new film The Guard. You started acting later than a lot of people. You taught school for 10 years, and then at age 34, I gather, when it went into acting full time. And one of your early roles, I believe, was with the TV drama The Treaty, where you auditioned for the role of Michael Collins, the Irish national leader. And I read that you won the role more with a tantrum than with a reading. Is this true?
It is true, because I'll tell you why, and it still annoys me. I had read Tim Pat Coogan's Michael Collins. He did a wonderful work on Michael Collins. He's such a fascinating character. The next thing was they were making this TV film of The Treaty, but I was asked to go into audition, but they would not tell me who I was going to audition for. Auditions can be really nasty in that way. Sometimes they give you lines, sometimes they don't. Sometimes they tell you the character, sometimes they don't. And I find it really insulting. I went in a fit of pique anyway, and I said, if they're going to tell me now that I have to audition for Michael Collins without giving me any script or anything, it's just not fair. And I went in and I attacked the director as soon as I heard it was going to be for Michael Collins. And I said, if I'd known about this, I could have prepared properly. And I started giving it out to him I really did lose my temper, actually. And he said, that's very like Collins. And he told me afterwards, yeah, we might have to pin your ears back and all this kind of stuff. But actually, I kind of did feel like that. I kind of felt they should treat people with more respect. But in the end, it worked to my advantage because I got the job.
You got a role in Braveheart as one of the friends of the Mel Gibson character, William Wallace. Was that like a breakthrough for you?
I was doing a play when Mel Gibson came over and was talking about doing Braveheart, and he came to see the play and had a chat with me afterwards, and I met him and we had a good chat. I really enjoyed his take on the whole thing. We talked a lot about history being written by the winners and all that kind of thing, and it was a fascinating project one way or the other. And then he came, I was performing, and he came in that night, and I think the following night or whatever, I was going ready to go on stage, and I got a call. And it was Mel, and he said, "So, do you want to do this?" I said, okay. and it was a fantastic moment. But yeah, I owe a lot to that production. It was the most phenomenal thing. It went on for about 6 weeks, I think, in Scotland, and then 4.5 months at home in Ireland. And just to be working at that level with the amount of extras and the whole production was just such a massive undertaking. It made a huge difference to me.
You were in the film In Bruges with Colin Farrell in 2008, and I just loved this film, and it gave it had a similar feel to your new movie, The Guard, and I had to wonder if they were by the same director. It turns out they are directed by brothers. John McDonough directs The Guard. Martin McDonough, his brother, directed In Bruges. I thought we would just listen to a clip. You want to just tell us the basic storyline of this film, what your character is?
Of In Bruges was, well, basically there are two hitmen arrive in Bruges, a city in Belgium, which is an extraordinary city. It's a little medieval haven that was left behind when the canals changed, and it's kind of a very beautiful little city, but not an awful lot goes on in it. And these two guys are there running away from a job that has gone wrong. And Colin Farrell is the younger guy and I'm the older guy. And the younger guy, it was his first job. I kind of got him in on it. He kept pestering me and I brought him in. And it all went horribly wrong and we ended up in Bruges just laying low.
Right. And one of the things that went wrong was that Ray, who's played by Colin Farrell, had actually ended up killing a boy.
And, yes.
And the clip I wanted to play was a moment where you've been touring some of the sites and have seen all of this medieval art with religious and moral themes, and you have a kind of a conversation about morality in your own lives. And the one linguistic thing I want to explain is there's a discussion of the term a lollipop man, which I gather is a school crossing guard, right?
That's exactly what it is.
So that'll make it a little easier to follow.
His stick looks like a lollipop, yeah.
Right, so this is Brendan Gleeson and Colin Farrell from the film In Bruges.
Yes, I have killed people. Not many people. Most of them are not very nice people. Apart from one person. Who's that? This fella, Danny Alaban's brother. He's just trying to protect his brother. Like you or I would. Just a lollipop man. He came at me with a bottle. What are you going to do? Shot him down.
In my book, though. Sorry. Someone comes at you with a bottle. That is a deadly weapon. He's got to take the consequences.
I know that in my heart. I also know that he's just trying to protect his brother, you know.
I know. But a bottle, that can kill you. It's a case of it's you or him. If he come at you with his bare hands, that'd be different. And that wouldn't have been fair.
Well, technically, your bare hands can kill somebody too. They can be deadly weapons too. I mean, what if you knew karate, say?
You said he was a lollipop man.
He was a lollipop man.
What's a lollipop man doing on karate?
I'm just saying.
How old is he?
About 50.
Well, what's a 50-year-old lollipop man doing on karate? What was he, a Chinese lollipop man?
And that's Colin Farrell and our guest, Brendan Gleeson from In Bruges. A lot of this is about this city, Bruges, this medieval city. Do you know how the elders and the citizens of Bruges reacted to it?
I do know how they reacted to it. First of all, before we'd even stopped shooting, they started putting up placards on streets saying this is where this was filmed. And they were really smart. We went in, we met the mayor, and I said, listen, mayor, I just want to thank, because the city is beautifully lit at night. You know, you walk through and it looks like a film set. And I just said, I'd like to thank you, Mr. Mayor, for lighting our set for us, you know. And of course, he laughed, and they had absolutely embraced the film, and even though there were some things that were said about Bruges that were not particularly complimentary in the film, they got the bigger picture and they embraced us when we went there. And then when we left, they began, you know, once the film came out, the tourism figures for Bruges went up by 33%.
Wow.
That's not a joke. That's a statistic. So they got it, and they had no problem laughing at themselves at any point. And people have just been flocking to see this place ever since.
You know, in 2009, you played Winston Churchill for the film Into the Storm. It was a BBC HBO production. And this is interesting because, you know, he is the very symbol of English power. And earlier in your career, you'd played the nationalist, Irish nationalist Michael Collins, who had opposed Churchill. Churchill, of course, was instrumental in the partition of Ireland. Did it give you any pause to play Churchill?
It did, certainly. Yeah, Thaddeus O'Sullivan, who directed the film, is another Irishman, which was kind of bizarre. And so we did a camera test. I mean, I was going to have to jump up a few years anyway, And it wasn't just a feeling of why would an Irishman play or a Southern Irishman play with Winston Churchill. There were things about the casting that I was there's a whole cultural leap that I wasn't sure I could make in terms of the aristocracy. You know, he was of the aristocracy and it's not something I'm particularly familiar with. So I didn't want to, you know, be part of my own miscasting apart from anything else. So we did a camera test, basically, and we played out a number of the scenes, and it became so full, chock block of dramatic possibilities, it became impossible to turn it down. We kind of felt, okay, we have to go for it.
Well, let's listen to one of those moments. This is a moment in the film where the English army is facing annihilation in France. This is before the evacuation of the army at Dunkirk, and you, as Churchill, are meeting with your advisors, and one of them says that, you know, we're in a terrible spot, and the Italians have reached out and suggested they might broker a deal with Hitler to deliver Britain from this disaster. And then you, as Churchill, respond. Let's listen.
Okay. Mussolini is prepared to act as an intermediary between us, the French, and Hitler.
Any hint of negotiation would destroy the morale of our people.
I think perhaps not in the present circumstances. The ambassador was most conciliatory, not at all extreme, very well-mannered. Of course, they would expect something in exchange.
Oh, of course.
Such as what?
Malta, perhaps. Gibraltar. Perhaps Uganda. Winston.
My dear Edward, if I thought we could get out of our present difficulties by giving up Malta, Gibraltar, a few of the African colonies, I'd jump at it. But Hitler cannot be trusted. No point in talking with the Itais.
The French are very keen. We should give it a try.
Yeah, the hell with the French. If they're not prepared to fight, let them give up. I will not allow this country to be dragged down a slippery slope. What is the point of becoming a slave state?
Oh, Winston, for the love of God, will you face facts? We could lose 250,000 men at Dunkirk.
Nations that go down fighting rise up again. There is a surrender tamely, are finished.
We cannot win this war without a devastating loss of life and resources. You'll destroy everything you most want to preserve.
And that's from the film Into the Storm. No mistaking Winston Churchill in that clip, played by our guest Brendan Gleeson. You know, it might be a little intimidating to take on such an iconic figure, and one that everyone has popular images and recollections of. Yeah. What was the trick to getting him?
I mean, there are two challenges. One is the iconic figure we all are familiar with, and the sound is so familiar, and you have to get that right. But there's a certain amount of mimicry that will get you half of the way there. What's more intimidating for me is the private voice. How does he speak with Clemmy, his wife? You know, he can't be speechifying the whole time. It would be very dull and not at all natural for him to do so. The initial temptation was to go down very low and do all this kind of thing. Whereas in actual fact, when we listened to the speeches, it was closer to my own pitch than I would have thought. We tried to get the voice into my own head so I could believe myself when I spoke, and that others could believe then that the character was who, you know, it purported to be. But that was the biggest one. I mean, after that, body language and all the rest of it is kind of a doddle. It's the whole notion of actually speaking with his voice and believing yourself while you do so.
Well, you know, the other thing that's a challenge here is you're a big guy. You're, 6'2". Churchill was short and portly. How did you manage that physically?
Oh, it's a great excuse to put on weight. If you could put on weight, you foreshorten yourself. And so I could be nice and easy with everything that passed my lips for a while, until I had to kind of just knock it on the head and say, take it easy. In fact, it took me a couple of years too long to get rid of it. But there are various tricks that you can use to help you, and they actually cast Into the Storm very well in that regard. You know, people were, they cast quite tall actors around me, which made it very easy. And once or twice I did little kind of groucho walks that would allow me to kind of stay below the general level. And, you know, there are little tricks you can use, but generally people forget. If you set up a few things early on, if you set up a few, tableaus, you can get away with murder afterwards. Once people buy it and believe it, the stature thing, it becomes less and less important as the thing moves through.
Brendan Gleeson, thanks so much. It's been fun.
Thanks, Dave. Thanks a lot.
Brendan Gleeson spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies. Gleeson stars in the new film, The Guard. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. We'll close with tenor saxophonist Frank Foster's best-known composition, Shiny Stockings. Foster died yesterday at the age of 82. Here's the Count Basie Band's 1955 recording of Silk Stockings, featuring Foster, who also did the arrangement. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, John Sheehan, and Heidi Simon. I'm Terry Gross.